Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Such a great way of putting it.
You know, here's a guy that goes to Bordeaux, sees what they're doing in Bordeaux, learns everything that they're doing, comes over here and sees how ridiculously backwards we are after Prohibition, and just applies simple winemaking technique here.
And cleanliness. I mean,
yeah, cleanliness. But also, you know, looking at the vineyard, looking at the right times to harvest, looking at balance, looking at how to age the wines. And I think, you know, he's such a major character in the modern world of Napa Valley wines.
It's amazing. I feel like he never gets enough credit. Not that people don't give him credit. I just feel like he deserves, you know, everything, because he was working like almost under duress in terms of resources at BV.
Yeah.
And imagine what he would have done if he had support.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And yet he's literally the godfather. I mean, everybody that you talk to, either in first person or some way, his influence permeated what happens today. It's absolutely fascinating, but he's mentioned with such reverence because I think that just the level of gratitude and awareness that, you know, goes his direction deservedly is uncanny.
I think every winemaker my age wants to find some sort of connection to him.
Yes.
I unfortunately only have a spiritual connection to him, but certainly thank him for what he did to this valley. I mean, it has changed for the better ever since he arrived. Very powerful person.
I kind of chuckle that Frenchman went to France to hire Russian viticulturists to bring him to California. If that's not the greatest story, I don't know what it is.
He's probably the only person that was crazy enough to come over here.
Yeah. No, it's and he actually, I'm sitting, again, as I mentioned, this beautiful backyard and looking at some very happy chickens in the back. But Andrew's initial specialty, as you know, is poultry. And that business tanked, which is how he even came to be in the wine world, which just blows my mind. Anyway, you were in Bordeaux not once but twice, running a major chateau. How did the second time come around? Is that Michel's fault as well?
Or? No, that's my fault.
Okay.
I fell madly in love with the sister of Christine Vallette and realized that it was time to leave.
Oh my God, joint love affair. I love that.
So I decided to move on, and at the time I was starting to get known in the town, in the cité médiévale, as they call it. and a crazy German guy was just getting his parents' chateau back in order. Mm. A guy named Otto Rettenmeier. And he was sent by his father, who had bought Chateau de Tour Figeac at the same time that the Count Nyberg bought Canon Le Gaffelière. Mm. And the Rettenmeiers and the Nybergs were very close friends. From back in Germany. Mm-hmm. And the Count Nyberg essentially forced the Rettenmeiers to buy a chateau in 1973. So they bought Chateau Le Tour Figeac, and they put it in charge of a management team and forgot about it. And they essentially forgot about it until the mid-90s, and then decided to revive this chateau. And I was still at Drolet-Mondeau, I became friends with Otto, and I would help him out with his property and try to get it going again. And his management team was just awful. and they had no interest in the vineyard. It was a wonderful vineyard that's right next door to Chateau Figeac, right across the street from Cheval Blanc. It's on that gravel plain that's such an important part of Saint-Emilion. Most importantly for its Cabernet Franc contribution to Saint-Emilion. And eventually I decided to come over and start working as the general manager of that property. And I couldn't help myself, and loved running the vineyard and loved making the wine. So I was a very busy manager, and just enjoyed that property. Especially there were 60-year-old Cabernet Franc vines planted on the property that were just fabulous and produced wonderful wines. We immediately converted the property to biodynamics. That was an interest of mine at the time. I've since become a defrocked biodynamicist, but we started the conversion process and never looked back, and started creating wines that were more serious at that property.
And biodynamics at the time certainly wasn't trendy, and it certainly wasn't something that, you know, was in vogue in any sense. It's just something that you felt strongly about. Is that why you started implementing those practices?
Well, I mean, mainly it was, I had a neighbor at Trois-Lamandeaux, Chateau Pavie-Mecquin. Mm-hmm. And Pavie-Mecquin was being run by a very unusual winemaker who's very well known now, Stéphane Durand-Incourt. Mm-hmm. And Stéphane had embraced biodynamics very early on and had converted the property to biodynamics. And in 1993, as the harvest started happening, we were sort of forced into harvesting that year, as in all years kind of in Bordeaux, by very intense rains coming into the region. And I mean, these rains were so intense that you could just smell the sea air.
Wow.
And just, you know, rain coming down in buckets, and the clay soils were just saturated with water. The gypsies doing the harvest that year were almost knee deep in this clay soils. And we harvested Cabernet Sauvignon at 9% potential alcohol in that vintage.
Oh, my
added
Lord.
A lot of sugar and hoped for the best. But I was sort of keeping a close eye on what was going on at Pavie-Mecquin because I was interested in this idea of biodynamics. And in that vintage, they lost 85% of their crop to mildew. And that made us all chuckle, you know, thinking, yeah. Oh, what is this biodynamics? Very stupid concept.
Yeah.
And we laughed very heartily until the Enprimeur tastings. And we tried the wine from Pavie-Mecquin, and it was sensational. You know, the little 15% that they got out of the vineyard was really something else. And I thought, wow, you know, what's going on here? And started looking at it more in depth, and started looking at what the chemicals that we were using in the vineyards were doing to the vineyards, and thought, well, let's look at this more in depth, and let's see what we can do here. And I mean, although today I still use a lot of techniques that I learned working with biodynamics, I've abandon the concept of strict biodynamics, but I will never abandon the concept of organic viticulture. I mean, it's so important to what I see as showing the terroir of a property.
I find it so refreshing and insightful, actually, that you came to it not from the philosophy, but from the taste perspective. You tasted the wine, and that's what sold you.
Yeah, I mean, if I came to it from the philosophy perspective, I would have gone insane. I mean, I find the philosophical aspect of it completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think especially, you know, from a California perspective, you're looking at a concept that's designed for the middle of Europe.
Yeah.
And everything is designed to get things ripe.
Yeah.
To bring heat, to bring ripeness, to bring sunshine to crops that rarely see ripeness.
Yeah.
And for a kid from California, that's not at all what we're looking for here.
No, and I find it utterly fascinating that you worked, you know, within sort of the first almost, I want to say, formative years of winemaking under such difficult conditions in Bordeaux. I mean, those weather events that you described, you had to have presented such a huge challenge to someone that was responsible for this huge property.
I think, you know, to me, I was so frightened, you know, this, I had never seen anything like this. You know, in California, we would just wait till the grapes ripened and then we would pick them.
Yeah.
And if you didn't grow grapes organically, it was, you know, why bother growing grapes in California? It's so easy to grow grapes organically.
Mm-hmm.
But to see this weather and to be forced to pick and to, you know, try to get ahead of the rot. And
yeah,
it's extraordinary.
It's trial by fire, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, in this case, by water. But
I mean, I learned a lot that made it for a vintage like 2011 in California. It was very important knowledge. Yeah. I think you still look at the wines of 2011, and anyone that has any sort of European experience made mm-hmm. good wines in 2011.
Absolutely.
You look at the, you know, the wines that Jean Hofflinger made, the wines that Philippe Melka made. They're wonderful wines.
Indeed.
And I think that that experience is very important.
So on a practical side, listeners need to take note that 2011, that was unfortunately panned wholesale by the press, was entirely erroneous in a sense that it's a baby with the bathwater type of situation. I feel like some of the most profound wines were made in that vintage because it was so challenging. And if you're really a fan of age-worthy wine, something that you need a little patience for, you know, great structure, great integrity, top winemakers such as yourself, they shined so much. So to me, it's a revelatory vintage.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, certainly age-worthy. Those wines are really age-worthy. Wonderful.
Yeah. So it sounds like you really found a home in Bordeaux, in a sense. You were living there. People really appreciated who you were and all the work that you've invested in.
I don't know that anybody appreciated me being there.
Well, I'd like to think that. I mean,
I was an American in a uniquely French world.
Yeah.
And people were angry about it.
Really?
People didn't like it. I got a lot of McDonald's comments. I was harassed a lot by people.
Oh, jeez, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I blame the English, the 300 years of English rule in Bordeaux made a very closed society.
I got this impression from talking about, you know, you making friends and being hired by another, you know, formidable property, that people really understood, you know, your talent, but clearly only few did, but the rest of this, you know, people that didn't understand really not just who you are, but you were very important at that time to those two properties. I know you wouldn't, you're humble, but from what it sounds to me, you really created a lot of, well, not only you created wines, but you've also created a lot of practices with biodynamics and paid very close attention. And I know that you're a very thoughtful person. And those kinds of things, once they're kind of permeating the culture of the brand, they don't just go away. So you've instilled something very, very special.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that people wanted to see me fail, and I think you know, when you when you start rubbing up against something that is so uniquely French in their mind, they don't want to see you succeed.
Well, they're lost. Because obviously you left. I'm not sure if there's an exact corollary, but at some point you made a decision that you want to return to the U.S. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I really left because of my parents. I realized at one point that I was seeing my parents one time during the year, at most, and they were getting older, and I thought that if I wanted to, I wanted to take advantage of the rest of their lives, I needed to come back here. And my mother called me up on the phone one day and said, I saw the strangest job offer in the classified ads of the newspaper. And I said, oh, really? What is it? And she said, it's a job looking for someone that can speak English, Spanish, Italian, French, and has winemaking experience to run the international brands for a large wine producer. Hmm. I said, oh, that sounds interesting. And she said, well, I sent your resume in.
Well, that's subtle.
Okay.
I want you back home, and I did something about it.
So, sure enough, I didn't know at the time, but nobody else applied for the job. And my mother got a letter back to my resume. And she said, well, you have an interview. You can have an interview, and you just need to call and set it up. So I called, and it turned out to be Beringer Vineyards. Mm-hmm. At the time, they were owned by the Texas Pacific Group and the Silverado Partners, and very independent company. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for someone to run their overseas winemaking operations. It was, you know, they were right in the middle of the second phylloxera ridiculousness. Mm-hmm. And there was such a shortage of wine in California that all of these big wine companies were spreading their wings and looking for other projects around the world. And mm-hmm. Beringer had done a good job with their organization called Wine World. It always reminds me of Wayne's World. Wine World, party time, excellent. But they had established brands in Chile and Argentina and Italy and France. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for someone to sort of smooth all of these wine brands out and be kind of a unifying force and travel amongst them and make sure that the quality was up to snuff.
And you actually spoke all those languages? Or
I spoke Spanish and French. Mm-hmm. And I spoke English fairly well. Mm-hmm. I was lacking in Italian.
Mm-hmm. But you can just gesture your way through an Italian
conversation. I mean, since I was the only person that applied, they were obliged to hire me, I think. But the first thing that they did was they sent me to Florence for a month of Italian lessons, and it was one of the most wonderful periods of my life because I was taking Italian 8 hours a day.
Wow.
Where you do 4 hours in the morning with a professor, and you would do a 2-hour lunch with a professor, one bottle of wine.
And just one?
Yeah, and the professor wouldn't drink, so it was always
good.
Up to me to finish off the wine, you know. And then you would do 4 hours in the afternoon. And on Wednesday afternoon, you would meet with Raffaello, and you would go to the museums. And all day Sunday, Raffaello would, you know, this wonderful curly hair. It looked like he stepped out of a Ghirlandaio painting or something.
Sounds very cherubic, yes.
You know, wonderful curly-haired guy. We'd talk to you in Italian about all, take you through all the museums and just talk about everything in Italian. So I picked up Italian quite quickly. And that was kind of the biggest part of my portfolio, was the Italian part, because I had a Castello di Gabbiano in Tuscany that I was working with. I had Travellini in Gattinara in northern Piemonte. And then they had a ridiculous brand that was originally Merlot, Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, and most importantly, Pinot Grigio, from the area, the Friuli area, and made in Collio.
That's such an undersung region. Io non so che tu parli italiano, parlo un pochissimo. It's not a test, I believe you, but I'm just so impressed.
Yeah, that was fun. I mean, my Italian is ever super rusty at this point, but I enjoyed that part of it the most, because it was discovering this new, you know, wonderful culture that I had always been interested in, but to get to see it more in depth was fabulous.
Did you buy your mom a really nice present?
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it how she's looking at classifieds, as you described it, for a job that might include winemaking description. Again, there's no hints there or anything.
The fact that it would even be there was amazing. But so my base in Europe, Behringer had a house that was in a place called Cap d'Agde, and I think they had bought this house sight unseen, and it was right on the Mediterranean. I arrived there in the middle of the night, and there were walls of glass looking out onto the beach, and all of these telescopes on the next to the windows, and I soon discovered that it was in Europe's largest nudist colony.
You know, I was feeling sorry for you when you were talking about Bordelais shining at their own peril, but now I don't anymore. I should qualify that hopefully it was an attractive nudist colony.
No, I think that's an oxymoron, attractive nudist colony. People that generally go to nudist colonies shouldn't be seen naked.
I know, why is that? That's a whole other podcast. So there you are in Italy, enjoying, hopefully looking away, right?
This is in France. This is southern France.
Oh, southern France. I'm sorry. And this is such a dream job.
It was an unusual job. I don't know if it was a dream job. It was fun, mainly because there was so much travel involved.
And yes.
You were kind of following the endless fall.
Yes, chasing harvest.
Yeah, and the depressing part about it was you would always miss spring.
Yeah.
So you were always kind of chasing the harvest. I had wonderful consultants for these projects, though. The project in France had two amazing consultants on the business side. Mm-hmm. A guy named Louis Jacquemont, who was an incredible, old school negociant, wonderful businessman from Beaujolais, who knew everything about Beaujolais and everything about the business, and just did business in such an old school, touchy-feely way that it was amazing to watch. And then on the winemaking side, they had hired for Behringer a guy named Jean-Louis Mondreau. And Jean-Louis Mondreau had been the winemaker at Château Latour from 1970 to 1983. And his father had died, and he had to go back to Entre-deux-Mers and take over his family's chateau.
Wow.
And was making wonderful wines in Entre-deux-Mers. And, I could call on him at any time, and just a fabulous guy. I'm going to go visit him in this summer. I'm very much looking forward to seeing him again. But he's the, as he calls himself, the godless father of my two children. So,
you know, your extraordinary fortune continues because you seem to attract people in positions that give you this extraordinary exposure to things. I know winemakers that would kill to have several harvests, and they you know, to go to Australia just so they could have another one in addition to one here in California. And I realize constant travel has its own negative sides, but you, again, early on, were able to experience so much. It was so intense for you.
Yeah, I think it was the, you know, repetition and working in Chile in very primitive conditions.
Yeah.
And getting to do so many fermentations in a year, looking at so many vineyards in a year. You know, every year we were doing it twice.
Yeah, of course.
And in multiple places and traveling between those places and being able to taste all of those different wines, it really broadened my palate, and I actually learned a little bit of diplomacy.
Yeah. It has to be an amazing value added, both on the winemaking side but also on the human side. I mean, that's the kind of experience that I think prepares you for just about anything.
Yes, that's true. I mean, you just fall in love with these places too. I don't think there's an unattractive wine region in the world. You know, you're in a beautiful band of 30 to 50 north and south latitude, that it's it's a wonderful part of the planet.
No, it definitely is highly addictive. Once you experience it, you can't go back to like some concrete box and go, I'm okay. Maybe not. So that job, again, must have given you so much insight and such. I hear that it was a lot of responsibility as well to be so many things to so many different entities. What happened, you know, how did you part ways with Behringer?
So Behringer in 2000 was purchased by Foster's,
okay.
Australian for Beer Mate.
Yes.
And one of the higher-ups in Foster's decided that he loved my Castello di Gabbiano.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went over there, and I lost Castello di Gabbiano. And so, feeling sorry for me, Ed Sabragia, who was a very great mentor and good friend, still a very good friend, felt sorry for me and said, oh, you know, we need to find Aaron something else.
Yeah.
I really didn't need something else. But they had just the year before purchased St. Clement Vineyards,
mm-hmm.
and felt like they needed somebody to push that forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so, without losing all of my crazy overseas clients,
mm-hmm.
I was pushed back to Napa Valley to run St. Clement.
Mm-hmm.
And that started a real love affair all over again with Napa Valley.
Mm.
And we worked with some wonderful vineyards.
Yeah, of course.
You know, wonderful vineyards on Howell Mountain, wonderful vineyards in Rutherford,
mm-hmm.
Fabulous experiences, and a very nice group of people.
Mm-hmm.
We had Jennifer Lamb working with us from Herb Lamb Vineyards, who's just a wonderful character. And,
yeah.
And it was a fun experience. You know, I kept bringing all of these young French interns mm-hmm. over, and for 3 years we made wines there. And then I got a call from Augustin Huneus at Quintessa. And he, you know, this is Augustin Sr. And he called me and said, you've got to come over here. And I said, okay, I'll come over and look and see what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a day with Augustin in the vineyards, and he's so charismatic and charming and wonderful, and offered me the world. And you're looking out at the vineyards of Quintessa thinking, ah, this is just heavenly, you know, and it satisfies all of your Medoc visions of winemaking.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.